that they'll also show this imaginary benefit. In setting up benefits measures, you need mechanisms that will isolate benefits and directly link them to the project. That's harder than it sounds, and sometimes needs very careful thought. It does no harm at all to get some help when thinking this through, and indeed it's a mark of professionalism to call in some help if you need it to get the business case right. In the case of benefits measures and avoiding benefits contamination, some input from a finance manager can be particularly helpful. When you are actually producing the business case, the format depends on who it's aimed at and your plan for the content. You can keep the business case very short and factual. However, if others have got to look at it for information, or perhaps to approve it, then you may need to add some explanation. If you do include more information, keep your target audience in mind. Keep it simple. However, don't talk down to your readers. You need to assess where they're at and then write at that level. Consider appendices. If the fine financial detail isn't of interest to the bulk of your readers, consider putting an outline in the main part of the business case and having an appendix with the full data. Spell out the benefits. What may seem obvious to you may not be so obvious to people outside that area or to senior managers at the top of the organization. If you have to put information forward in a set format for financial approval, try not to separate that work out from the project's business case and so end up doing the work twice. Instead, adjust the business case format to fit the approval submission, put any extra information needed for the project into appendices, and then don't include the appendices in the copy that goes to the finance committee. Having set down the justification and benefits, it's time to revisit the scope to check it in two ways. To challenge the scope, to see whether you need to add anything. In both cases, you work within any set constraints unless you think that you need to challenge such constraints and you're in a position to do that. You won't be able to challenge things like changes in the VAT rate, but you may well be in a position to challenge a constraint that you must use a particular brand of equipment, if new equipment has come onto the market from a different manufacturer that's cheaper to buy, technically more advanced, and much easier to maintain. For each area of the project, systematically check whether it's really worth doing or whether you could cut it out. For some things, the considerable project effort needed to include something simply isn't worthwhile, given the very limited benefits that will result. When challenging the scope, do bear in mind that some things are necessary even though they won't directly produce benefits. Keeping within the main thrust of the project, could you add anything usefully to the project to deliver extra benefit? It may be that you're already doing a substantial amount of work, and by adding just a very small amount of additional functionality, you could get considerably better benefits. This step isn't to encourage scope creep, but rather to get the maximum possible value from the project. A few techniques can help with business cases. First, calculating return on investment. The return on investment, ROI, is a simple division of the quantifiable benefits by the project cost in a stated period. Perhaps the project will cost £1 million, but will lead to £5 million of benefits. 5 million divided by 1 million equals ROI of 5. This ROI figure is useful, but remember that the project may have important non-quantifiable benefits, and the benefits projections may not be 100% accurate in any case. To make the ROI figure meaningful, you should also state the time needed before the return. This has been called the dollar day. Investing £1 million and getting a return of £5 million within 1 year is very different from having to wait 10 years for the same return. Second, understanding cost-benefit analysis. Cost-benefit analysis is the most widely used technique for project business cases. The techniques may sound complicated, but really it's very simple. You set down the costs of the project and compare them with the savings or benefits over a period of 5 years or so to see when the project will pay back or break even. The direct payback or break-even model is useful, but it leaves out an important factor. Future money isn't as valuable as today's money. If I offered you £5,000 and asked whether you'd like it today or whether you'd prefer the £5,000 in 5 years' time, what would you reply? Well, today, without doubt, and for two reasons. The first is, you'd prefer to get your hands on the cash while I'm still feeling generous. The second is that in 5 years' time, the money won't be as valuable. It won't have the same spending power. The further you go into the future, the less valuable money becomes. What you need to do in order to have a more realistic view is to discount the value of future money. The further you go into the future, the more you need to discount it. Chapter 4. Knowing the Stakeholders. Often, a project is like an iceberg. 9/10 of it lurks below the surface. You receive an assignment and you think you know what it entails and who needs to be involved. Then as the project unfolds, new people emerge who may affect your goals and your approach to the project. Unless your project is one of a small minority that only really affects you and your immediate staff, you need to carefully consider the various stakeholders. The area of project work you're involved in with stakeholders is called, not surprisingly, stakeholder management. Although that term has become a buzzword, don't dismiss it, because this part of project management can ultimately hold the key to success or failure in your project. A stakeholder can be any person or group that supports, is affected by, or is interested in your project. Project stakeholders may be located inside your organization or outside, or both. In addition to making sure that your project has maximum support, knowing who the stakeholders are helps you to consider whether, when, and how to involve them, understand your project communication needs, determine whether the reach and impact of the project is bigger or smaller than you originally anticipated. You risk compromising your project in two ways when you don't involve key people or groups in your project and in a timely manner. You may miss important information that can affect the project's performance and ultimate success. Usually more painful, you may upset someone. And you can be sure that when people feel slighted or insulted or just plain overlooked, they're more likely to oppose your project than become wildly enthusiastic supporters. Do stakeholder problems mean you should give up immediately? No, of course not. But such people issues do mean that in order to be successful, you need to manage the soft people side of the project as well as the hard skills side that includes things like planning. Identifying stakeholders can simply mean that you sit down and think through the project and its environs, but it's often useful to talk to other people in the project who may think of people or groups that don't immediately spring to your mind. As you identify the different stakeholders in your project, you may find it helpful to record them in the form of a stakeholder list. As you develop your communications management plan, for example, you can quickly scan the list to make sure you haven't left anyone out. A stakeholder list is a living document. You can start developing your list as soon as you begin thinking about your project, rather than risk forgetting them. When you discuss your project with other people, ask them who they think may be affected by or interested in your project. To help ensure that you include all appropriate people, you may find it sensible to structure your list with categories. You can work out your categories, but here's one example. Internal, people and groups inside your organization. End users, people who'll use the things that the project will produce. Groups needed just for this project. Teams and individuals with special, often technical knowledge related to this project. Requesters, the person who came up with the idea for your project and all the people through whom the request passed before you received it. Senior management, executive-level management responsible for the general oversight of all organizational operations. Specialist interests, groups typically involved in most projects in the organization, such as the human resources, finance, contracts, and legal departments. Team members, people assigned to the project whose work the project manager directs. External, people and groups outside your organization. Business partners, groups or organizations with which you may pursue joint ventures, including perhaps this project. Clients or customers, people or groups that buy or use your organization's products or services. Professional societies, groups of professionals that may influence or be interested in your project. Regulators, government and agencies that establish regulations and guidelines that govern some aspects of your project work. Staff associations and unions, partly because they can often make valuable contributions to the project, but also because they may get direct inquiries from staff about it and need information to respond. The public, the local, national, and international community of people who may be affected by or interested in your project. the media. If your project is in the public spotlight, the media can have a strong influence on people's perception of your project, good or bad. Vendors, suppliers, and contractors. Organizations that provide staff, raw materials, equipment, or other resources required to perform your project's work. All of the interest groups in those lists are important, but a particularly important one is senior management. Surveys of project failure show that a very common cause of problems is lack of senior management buy-in. If your project is anything other than small, or is going outside the boundaries of your own work area, you must do your very best to secure this buy-in. Otherwise, senior management is likely to undermine your efforts on the project, such as by seeing the project as unimportant and transferring staff or funds to other areas partway through. Such undermining often happens because the senior managers were never seriously committed to the project in the first place. Many project methodologies have senior management representation on the project management team, and usually in the powerful position of having ultimate responsibility for the project. That representation and structure is no coincidence and helps lock in senior management commitment to the project. As you develop your stakeholder list, be particularly careful to think through the following areas because they're easy to overlook. End users of your project's products. Involving end users at the beginning and throughout your project helps ensure that the products and services delivered by the project will work successfully. In some cases, you don't know who the end users are, such as potential buyers of a new retail product. Instead, choose people who understand and represent the interests of those end users, such as sales and marketing staff. People who will maintain or support the final product. Involving these people throughout your project gives them a chance to make your project's products easier to maintain. It also allows them to become familiar with the products and prepare for the future maintenance. Support staff. Support areas include finance, legal, HR, human resources, and the project office if you have one. If support staff know about your project early, they can fit you into their work schedules more readily. They can also tell you information about their capabilities and processes that may influence what your project can accomplish and by when. Specialists, such as legal specialists, prefer to be involved early on so that they can check that things are right and give you a steer if needed. Involving specialists early on is much better than not consulting them, but then calling for them later in a flat panic because you've encountered serious legal problems and need the specialists to put in huge effort to dig you out of the mess. If you think that your project may have a legal dimension, put your organization's legal advisors on your stakeholder list. As the project develops, you may well discover more people who have a genuine interest in it. Keep the stakeholder list up to date, and then review it periodically to see how you need to keep people informed and how you need to involve them. If you need to develop a stakeholder list for most of your projects, consider setting up a template that contains typical categories and stakeholders. Using a template can save you time and improve your accuracy. Stakeholder analysis is considering each stakeholder to ask where she is with a project, frequently in the two dimensions of degree of influence and then her positive or negative view of the project. You may set out to actively change the position or outlook of certain stakeholders, but to do that, you clearly need to establish first where they are now. The stakeholder matrix is a simple idea, but a powerful one, because it helps you see where stakeholders are in terms of their support of the project and the degree of influence over it. It helps you consider where you need to try to change that position. 1. This person is neither for nor against the project and has medium influence over it. Your priority is to make this person much more positive about the project, and then, if you succeed, you can move on to try and make the person more influential. 2. This person is a project champion, very much in favor of the project, and is also in a position of significant influence. Be careful how you think about people in this area of the matrix. An initial reaction may be that you don't need to do anything, but actually you must work to make sure that they stay on side and enthusiastic. 3. The third person is really for your project, but doesn't have much influence. The question for this person is whether you do something to increase her influence and so make her support more effective. 4. Here is the opposition, and quite serious opposition too. Not only is the person firmly against your project, but she also has a high degree of influence. You need to work to convince her that the project is worthwhile and so get her support. If you're a more political player, you might also be looking to see whether you can reduce this person's influence. Although the matrix is extremely useful in getting a picture of where individual stakeholders are, it's also useful for seeing the overall distribution. For example, you may see that the majority of the stakeholders are in favour of your project, but that relatively few of them are in a position of influence. If you want to, you can also make the matrix more sophisticated by showing the position of stakeholders before any management action, and your assessment of their position after management action is in place. Before you can try to maintain or change a stakeholder's position, you need to understand why a person or group has taken a particular stance. When someone has objections to the project, it's important to hear those objections. And hearing means working hard to understand and trying to see things from the stakeholder's position. In some cases, those making the objections reduce their opposition when they feel that they've at least been heard, rather than just plain ignored. Another reason for a negative stance is lack of understanding about the project, or even misunderstanding. Sometimes they're scared to commit because they aren't sure exactly what they're committing to. If a stakeholder has a positive stance, then, perhaps strangely, you also need to understand why. You can't protect a position until you know the underlying reasons for it. The stakeholder may be a massive fan of your project because it will deal with a problem that's plagued her staff for years. If the project comes under pressure of time and budget, and the plan shows that you need to reduce the scope, you do well to think twice before cutting the part that deals with that stakeholder's problem. Your stakeholder management now moves clearly from the analysis part into the action part as you consider what you need to do. On the one hand, you may want to consolidate a stakeholder's current position to make sure, for example, that the person stays enthusiastic and on side. On the other hand, you may want to try and change the stakeholder's position, particularly if it's currently against the project. Your responsibility as a project manager is to deliver the project. What you can't afford is to manage your stakeholders superbly but fail in that project delivery. So you have to balance out stakeholder management, exactly what effort is needed and how much work can be justified. Don't think that working with stakeholders is all down to you as a project manager. If you have more senior managers involved in the project, perhaps on a project steering committee or as sponsors, talk to them about stakeholder issues. They may be better placed than you to take the agreed actions and so be much more effective. Having decided that you need to involve some of the stakeholders or at least communicate information to them, you need to decide how best to do that. Think about approval. Before completing the project, you may need to get approval from stakeholders who have authority to make decisions. Communication. How you'll communicate information, such as on the impact the project will have, its progress and benefits projections. Consultation. Do you need to get agreement from stakeholders at particular points in the project? How will you do that? Or if you're constrained by procedures, how must you do that? Participation. When making organisational change, you can get people on side more easily if you involve them in the change process. So how will you do that? For example, you may get operational staff involved to help design new procedures. That helps ensure that the procedures work, but also that the operational staff own them from the outset. A lot of stakeholder management actions relate to communications. It follows that as you think about the stakeholders, you adjust the communications management plan. In medium to large projects particularly, consider briefings, such as a lunchtime 20-minute illustrated talk once a month. News sheet, an illustrated project bulletin circulated to everyone with an interest in the project. Roadshow, going around to the regional offices before the product launch. Website, a dedicated website for the project with news and progress information, excluding anything sensitive. Use these strategies with care because they take effort, but one or more may be a really effective way of communicating information to important stakeholders. Some work to manage stakeholders is effectively continuous, such as keeping everyone up to speed with progress and new developments on the project. Other work focuses on particular points. You need to think through your own project, come up with your own requirements, and then build the actions into the plan at the appropriate points. If one or more people are dead set against your project, then you've got problems. However, although serious, such problems aren't insurmountable. People rarely take action or hold a position without a reason, no matter how valid or invalid you think that reason is. Try hard to find out why a person is opposing your project. If people are opposed to your project because it will cause genuine problems, do your best to make adjustments so that the project won't cause problems. Remember that sometimes objections are valid. Taking this approach can result in a win-win. You avoid the problems, and the people who raised the objections are now really impressed that you listened and then worked with them to solve the difficulties. Try to identify common areas and major on what you have in common, not on points that divide, especially if those points are minor. Sometimes people lose all sense of proportion when making negative arguments. Minor issues that are molehills assume the proportions of mountains and then obscure nearly everything else. When looking for underlying reasons for a negative stance, consider the idea that people are probably seeing you, your project, or both as a threat. Projects, by definition, are usually changing something, and generally people don't like change. You may not notice people's dislike of change at first because you probably like change, or else you wouldn't be involved with projects. It's natural enough to think that other people see the project the way you do, so you may be puzzled as to why they don't share your enthusiasm. Or maybe Operation Cover-Up is underway. If a managing director promotes a project at the company meeting by saying it will change the face of our whole operation, everyone may clap and smile and say, "Wonderful idea," to each other, while saying secretly to themselves, "Over my dead body." You need, then, to reduce the threat. Try the following. 1. Be scrupulously honest. One thing guaranteed to heighten threat and fear is distortion. People need to know that when you say something, it's true. That way they learn to trust you instead of the rumor mill. 2. Be open. Make as much known about the project as possible. If people think you're hiding things, they imagine all sorts of nasty, threatening reasons why. That's completely unnecessary if the information wasn't secret in the first place. 3. Act open. It's surprising how little things can increase or decrease the feeling of threat. If you're talking to someone and want to take notes, ask her permission, even if she's very junior. The person is highly unlikely to say no, but the act of asking gives her the feeling of being in control, which runs counter to feeling threatened. Also, ask if you can send her a copy afterwards to check that you've got the details right. Again, all of this signals openness, which does a lot to play down threat. 4. Involve people as much as you can. Involvement is a key component in change management, and your project is about change. Nobody likes things being imposed on them, and a hugely different dynamic exists where people are involved. 5. Understand the extent and strength of opposition. Use techniques such as force field analysis to model the forces at play so you can understand them and the overall dynamic of the project better. You can find information on this technique in publications like Inspirandum's The Project Techniques Toolbox by Nick Graham. Well, that's it for the kind stuff. Now, on to the tough stuff. If you have serious opposition but the project must get done, you need to stamp on the opposition. Such stamping presupposes that you've done everything possible to win over the opposing stakeholders. As a project manager, you probably won't have the personal authority to do much stamping. Even if you're fairly high grade, the chances are that your project is cross-functional and the opposition is coming from another department where you don't have any authority. The answer in this case is to go higher. For example, work with your project sponsor to get the managing director to issue a notice saying that this project is going ahead and that she requires staff in all departments to cooperate to ensure that the project is successful. Now, if anyone opposes you or the project, they put themselves in opposition to the management board. Don't stamp unless you really, really need to, and all else has failed. After you've got heavy, you'll almost certainly have eliminated any further possibility of winning people over. The cooperation you do now get is likely to be half-hearted, and the bad feeling it creates will last long after the end of the project. Part 2. Building the Plans. Chapter 5. Planning with Deliverables First. If you've been around projects for a while, you've seen the planning approach in which you first list all the activities or tasks for a project and then draw up a Gantt chart with its familiar horizontal bars. To help you get to your task list, you may also have used a hierarchical diagram in which you can break down the major activities into more detail to determine a working list of tasks. This chapter, however, starts the planning up front of the activities. It starts with thinking about, understanding, and defining what you need to deliver. Then, when you're as clear as you can be on what you're going to deliver, you can start thinking through what activities you need to build those deliverables. This is a product-led or product-based approach to planning and also gives you some extremely powerful techniques. The product-led approach is logical, and it's hard to overstate just how very good it is. Not only is it an enormous help in planning, but it also opens the door to particularly effective quality management and progress control. You can't really argue with the logic of the product-led approach. How can you possibly determine activities and time durations with any accuracy if you're unclear about what it is you're going to build? Many approaches to project management refer to deliverables as products. What you produce are the products. To show the logic of looking at deliverables or products first, the following example follows the process of activity-led planning to show where it can create some problems. Okay, we're working on a project, and our computer software tells us to list the activities first. We write on our list, build the wall, because that's going to be an important element in this project, which involves some alterations to our headquarters building. After we've entered this and the other tasks, the next step is to draw bars on a Gantt chart to indicate the time duration. Please say, then, how long it takes to build a wall. You probably want to start asking questions about the wall, such as how high it will be and how long, and the sort of finish required. But you miss the question and aren't helping. The software says that step two is to enter the time duration, not start a debate, so please give your estimate. How long does it take to build a wall? The example shows a significant problem when you start planning with the activities. Activities are a comfortable place to start, but not a logical place. The comfort comes because people normally think activity when faced with a project. Oh, I need to do this, and I must remember to do that. It's do, do, do. But how can you accurately determine the activities needed to build a brick wall and how long they're likely to take unless you first defined what it is you mean by brick wall? So, you were right to want to ask questions. The sorts of questions that you may think about are, how long is the wall and how high? The height is significant because we'll need scaffolding if the wall is higher than about 2 meters. When you say wall, does that include the foundations? Where's the wall going to be? If it's at the front of a building and in full public view, it needs to be neatly finished. But if it's a supporting wall that'll be covered by an earth bank, we can leave it rough. Will the wall be one brick deep or two? If the wall is in public view, is it to be plain brick, Flemish bond, or some intricate design with a company logo in 3D? Whatever the product, you need to define and understand it so that you can determine what tasks you need to do to create the product and how long those tasks will take. If you're already deeply into activity-driven approaches, your response may well be that you do this sort of thinking already. If you do respond like that, great, because you're already halfway there. The product-led approach just emphasizes that line of thinking and gives you some particularly powerful techniques to help. Please note carefully that taking a product-led approach doesn't do away with activity planning. Activity planning is powerful and isn't only advantageous but also absolutely essential. But product planning provides a very logical and powerful front end. Starting instead with activities brings two problems. Until you have a clear idea of what you need to build, you aren't going to have a clear idea of the activities needed, and are highly likely to miss some out. In turn, that means that you're likely to underestimate the effort and time needed for the project, which indeed is a very common cause of project problems. Even where you correctly identify activities, time estimates are likely to be wrong. Returning to the example of the task to build a wall that we use in the previous section, clearly, a great deal of difference exists between the time needed to build a small garden wall and the time needed to build something on the scale of the Great Wall of China. Many projects, encouraged by books and software, plunge into activity planning without proper thought about what is to be produced. It's no wonder, then, that estimates of time and cost are inaccurate, and the project is then plagued with problems where essential work is identified during the project that isn't on the plan. Many timesheets built into project scheduling software have a section for unscheduled activity, where project staff can report work they're having to do that wasn't foreseen. Such problems lead to projects being late in delivery and overspent on budget. There are a few refinements on what products are, but the starting point is simple. A product is something that one of your project teams builds. When a team leader comes up to you and says, "We finished it, here it is." What is it? A product is something that you can hold in your hand, or if it's too big for that, walk up and kick. Products in your projects might include brick wall, you can kick it. Computer program, you can print it out and hold it. Decorated room, you can stamp around it and kick the walls, though try not to dirty the new paint. Instruction manual, you can hold it. Things that aren't products but are commonly mistaken for them are designers. That's a staff resource. The designers are the people who create your product office design document. Unless your project is quite long and rather exciting, you won't be making people. Money. That's a resource. Unless you work for the Royal Mint or your own country's equivalent, actually producing money is illegal and you can spend years in prison for it, causing substantial project delay. Jobsworth Office Furnishings Limited. That's a source of supply. The products are likely to be desks and chairs, and Jobsworth Office Furnishings Limited is where you bought them. Walls built. That's a point in time when the walls have all been built. You don't kick walls built. Instead, the products that you kick are built walls, or more simply, walls, because if they aren't built, then they aren't walls. Writing programs. That's a task or activity. Notice the verb, write. As you think about your project's products, you may come up with better and more appropriate names for some of them. If you're particularly fast-thinking, you may have said to yourself that Jobsworth Office Furnishings Limited might well be a product if the project includes setting up the company. That's true, but then the product name isn't a particularly good one. The product that you hold in your hand isn't going to be the company, but rather something like company registration document. As you work through the products, you're likely to think of better, more descriptive names for some. So, change them. Product names should be short and descriptive. Later on, you'll be drawing up some diagrams, and you need short names to go into the boxes on the diagrams. If you have long, unwieldy names, you'll be tempted to use numbers instead, and that can cause problems. Where you're working on a project that involves other people, which is usual, then stick to the terminology in use in their part of the organization. If the engineering staff refer to something as the upgrade plan, and in your diagrams you call the product modification schedule, the engineers won't recognize the product and won't be able to say whether the diagrams are correct. Stay with their names and note down separately the definition of them if it's not obvious to you from the product titles. It's extremely important to use names on the diagram and not numbers. If you replace text with numbers, perhaps because you've chosen very long product names, the diagram loses meaning. If you have to look up the product numbers, you'll only ever understand a part of the diagram at a time. You're also likely to miss dependencies because you can't remember what all 30 product boxes are. Sooner or later, you'll make a bad mistake, and sure as eggs is eggs, it'll be sooner. The problem with numbers reinforces the point that you should find short, descriptive product names so that they fit easily into the boxes and so you won't be tempted to replace the names with numbers. If you want to use numbers as well as names, that's fine, and actually an advantage, because you can quickly look up the relevant product definition. For each product on the diagram, you now write a product definition, sometimes known as a product description. Product definition is really a better term because it includes a description, but rather more besides. Have you ever heard a conversation that includes the words, "Oh, I thought you meant..." It's that sort of conversation, with the accompanying problems of wasted money and of project delay, that the product definition does so much to avoid. The product definition simply defines what the product is, and also includes information on the quality criteria it must satisfy and how it will be tested to make sure that it does meet them. As with the rest of product-led planning, the case for the product definition is logical. If you're going to ask a team or an individual to build something for you, you're going to have to define what it is. You may find this simple list of headings useful as a default, but you can always alter the headings to suit your own particular organization or even a specific project. Reference, a product number. Author and date, the person responsible for this particular product definition. Description, a textual description of the product. Sub-products, if this product is made up of any lower-level components. Quality criteria. What quality criteria must the product satisfy to be acceptable? Tests, to ensure that the product meets its quality criteria. Required resource. What team hours, skills, and costs you anticipate you need to build the product and to test it. Responsibilities. As you get into more detailed planning, you can enter the names of the people or team who'll be building the product and those who'll be testing it. In many projects, it can be a real help to use a bit of structure and think through the project in an orderly way, looking at different categories of product in turn. For example, if the project is a house build, you might first list all the brickwork products, then all the electrical products, then woodwork products, and finally, decorating products. For the electrical products, you might find it easier still if you break that into two subcategories and think first about the lighting circuit products and then the power circuit products. Using categories provides some helpful structure and forms a hierarchy. No rules exist about the groupings or categories. They're just what help you to think through the project systematically. In larger projects involving contracts, a common grouping is by contract. If the subject of the whole project is unfamiliar to you and you don't know what the high-level categories are, just go straight for the workflow diagram and don't do the work breakdown structure. The workflow diagram is helpful in that case because it is a network diagram and you don't have to start at the top. You can start anywhere with the information you have. The workflow diagram, WFD, is extraordinarily useful and powerful. A big advantage of using the diagram is finding missing products. The diagram is great for this and reveals missing parts of the project that other techniques, such as the Gantt chart and activity network, just don't, or don't do very well. Now that's significant, because if you establish the real scope of the project at the beginning, you can then think what activities are needed to build the products and so have a more complete project plan. Some projects fly off the plan almost as soon as they start, and the problem isn't with the project, it's with the incomplete plan that significantly understates the project. In a large project in a multinational company, the project manager decided not to use the product planning approach and went straight in with activities and the Gantt chart. At a progress meeting 1 month into the project, the project team had already discovered a lot of additional but essential work, and they estimated that after 1 month, the project was already 1 month behind. Your organization is probably unique in that you have absolutely no problems with external supply. Suppliers, other organizations, and other projects always provide you with exactly what you need, exactly when you need it. They never, ever let you down. No? Oh, so you live in the real world as well, then. The workflow diagram is superb for revealing dependencies on things that are coming in from outside the project. For each one, you can ask yourself whether the supply is likely to be a problem. In some cases, if that supply fails, you can quickly and easily get an identical or similar product from somewhere else. In other cases, though, you find that you can't easily replace the supply, and so that external dependency needs to be risk managed. A second use of the diagram in risk management is to use it as part of the risk analysis. You can work systematically through the diagram and ask for each product, what can go wrong with developing this one? It flushes out risks that other risk analysis techniques may not find. Another powerful use of the workflow diagram is to bring a highly effective control point into the project by deliberately creating a bottleneck. In the UK, Inspirandum used this when providing project consultancy to a power company. The company had a project to bring a new and novel approach in to control part of the operational side of power supply, but the project team members weren't sure that what they were trying to do was even theoretically possible. What they needed was a proof-of-concept product fairly early in the project. Only if they could demonstrate that the idea was at least theoretically possible would the project manager allow more substantial work on the project to go ahead. Dependencies were changed to make the product a bottleneck in the workflow diagram. The workflow diagram is sequential, and because of that, you can map phase or stage boundaries on it. If you wish, you can mark them on with dotted lines, and so see them clearly. Many, or actually most, project planning tools and books suggest that you monitor progress using percentage complete on activities. So, this particular activity is 60% complete. Computer planning software often shows the percentage complete on Gantt charts by filling up the activity bar like a thermometer. Very pretty, but known to be generally unreliable. Who says the activity is 60% complete? Can you prove it? No. Normally it's somebody's guess. Sorry, somebody's estimate. When they're saying that their task is nearly finished, perhaps the team really think it is. Then they find a huge problem, and they have to do a lot of the work all over again. Or perhaps, though not in your organization, of course, the team say, nearly finished, to keep the project manager happy, and off their backs for another week or two. The thing about products is that they're either delivered or not delivered. Delivered, by the way, means checked and signed off. If the product hasn't been checked and signed off, then it isn't delivered. Progress monitoring, then, becomes a matter of factual reporting, which products are complete and which aren't. You can make a useful delivery checklist listing all the products in a stage as milestones, and, after you complete the activity planning, recording the target completion date for each product. Then, when the product is signed off, you can record the actual completion date. Taking the progress monitoring a bit further, you can also color-code the project or stage workflow diagram and ask yourself where the project is at this point in time. No-brainer, isn't it? Using color or shading turns the workflow diagram into a superb visual progress chart based not on an opinion or estimate of progress, but on factual reporting of delivery. You can make the diagram even more meaningful by using colors such as gray for products not yet started, orange for those underway, green for those that are finished, and red for those that are overdue or which are projected to be late. If you've been involved in project management for a while, think about the Gantt chart from the project before the one you're currently working on. Can you remember it? Can you remember the one from the project before that? Can you even remember the Gantt chart from your current project? Your answer to all three questions is likely to be no. Gantt charts are excellent, but they all look pretty much the same. A further advantage of the workflow diagram is that it provides a picture of your project that's memorable and that you can hold in your head. Chapter 6. You want this project done when? Project assignments often have deadlines, but even if you don't have a deadline imposed on you, you'll want to know when the job will be finished. For one thing, you have other work to move on to, but then other people may need to know when your project will deliver in order to fit in with what you're delivering or changing. When you find out the required end date, your immediate reaction is often one of panic. But I don't have enough time! Don't worry. One major reason to do the planning is to make sure that you can meet the end date with time to spare. The first part of activity planning is to build an activity network. Some people think this first step is very difficult, so much so that project management software tools usually have an option to avoid the network and instead model the activity dependencies with arrows on the Gantt chart. You don't need to miss out on the power of the activity network technique, though. Switch off the Gantt arrows option if you're using a computer tool and prepare for something that's powerful and basically very easy. In this chapter, you find out how to move from products to activities and how to draw up an activity network that you can use to work out how long the project will take and that you can work with to help meet any fixed end date. Then finally, you see how to move all the information onto a Gantt chart. Having established what the deliverables or products of the project are, moving to activity planning is very easy. You simply ask, what work is needed to build this product? Bear in mind that you personally may not know. Don't worry, just go and ask people who do know. You can ask team members, specialists, suppliers, in fact anyone who knows the answer. You probably already have a good idea about who to ask, because you consulted them when listing and defining the products in the first place. There may be a single activity or task to build a particular product, but for many products you can expect to have more than one task. A simple example is with the two tasks of build it and test it. These are two tasks for a single product, often using different staff resources. You can produce a list in one of three ways: as a simple list, noting the tasks on the workflow diagram, or by noting the tasks on the work breakdown structure. To determine the amount of time you need for any project, you have to decide the sequence in which the activities will be done and how long each will take. The duration. For example, suppose you have a project consisting of 10 activities, each of which takes 1 week to complete. How long will it take to complete your project? The truth is, you can't tell. It will take between 1 and 10 weeks, depending on how many activities you can run in parallel. The technique that's really helpful here is the activity network. Although finally the diagram will deal with project timing, you start by focusing on the sequence, the dependencies between the activities. Computer tools are a particular help with activity networks. Even if you're intending to use a tool, though, it's important to understand the techniques so that you properly understand what the computer tool is doing for you. The workflow diagram is a great help when moving on to the activity network. If you take the workflow diagram and lie it on its side, you have the basic framework of the activity network already. For a particular product, you may now have 2 or 3 activities, so you may have 2 or 3 activity boxes where you used to have 1 product box. You need to think through and then draw in any dependencies between those tasks. You lie the workflow diagram on its side because, by convention, workflow diagrams go from top to bottom, whereas activity networks go from left to right. Although the orientation of the diagram may be mere convention and seems unimportant, if you're ever going to have to work with other people who use these diagrams, it's best to get used to the standard approach. Reading a diagram that's flowing in a different direction from the one you're used to is surprisingly hard. Activity planning is much faster to do if you've done product planning first. You, or team specialists, can more easily determine what activities are needed and estimate how long they're likely to take, rather than just guessing. Now comes the bit where this technique starts to reveal some real power. Having established the dependencies between activities, the next step is to put some times onto the activities and, among other things, work out how long the project is going to take. For each activity, you need an estimate of how long it will take to do it. The activity network works with calendar time, sometimes referred to as elapsed time. If you have a task to do that requires 10 days' effort, but you can only spare half of each day to work on it, it's going to take you 20 elapsed days. Equally, if you can work on it full-time and a colleague can work with you and can also devote full days, then that 10 days of staff effort will only take 5 days of elapsed time, provided you don't get distracted and start arguing about the football or pop idols. At first, you can put in a provisional duration based on the amount of staff resource you expect to be available. You can make adjustments later. These are the initial timings. There's no way out of it. Estimating is difficult to get right. If you find a way of getting accurate estimates every time, then patent the idea quickly and prepare to be very rich. Different industries have different approaches to estimating, but the bottom line is that the most useful information you can have to hand is how long it took last time you did an activity like this. It's worth keeping historic information from past projects because they can be an invaluable source of estimating data for future projects. Where you don't have that information, you do the best you can. But remember, you can always ask other people too, such as technical specialists in the organization. This is where product planning comes in useful, because you can say exactly what it is you're building, and in turn that helps the specialists estimate more accurately based on their experience. The following can all affect an activity's duration: the amount of work effort required to complete the activity, people's availability, whether people can work on the activity at the same time, availability and capacity of non-staff resources, for example, a computer's processing speed, delay, for example, if your boss takes a couple of days to get around to spending an hour reading your proposal, In many cases, you can see up front that the duration of an activity is dependent on something other than work effort. This situation is quite common in business projects, where a manager who's both very senior and very busy must do something. That manager may tell you that she'll do the 3 days project work you need from her, but she can't tell you exactly when she'll do it within a given 2-week period, because her availability depends on the other demands on her time. In that case, you can enter the activity into the plan as fixed duration of 2 weeks, and note separately for project costing that, in fact, it involves only 3 days of that manager's time. Understanding the basis of a duration estimate also helps you work out ways to reduce it. For example, suppose you estimate a test requires 24 hours running on a specialized machine. If you can use the machine for only 6 hours a day, the test duration is 4 days. Doubling the number of people working on the test won't reduce the duration to 2 days, but getting approval to use the machine for 12 hours a day, perhaps at night, will. It's useful to know which activities have some slack time, and that's the next thing to find out. This is a great help when managing the project, because if someone reports that her activity is more difficult than she thought and will take a week longer than planned, you know immediately whether you can absorb that week or whether it may cause a problem. The term slack is a very descriptive one for the amount of spare time for an activity. However, the international word for this time is float, and computer tools usually use that term. Knowing the float is actually a bit better than just knowing whether you can delay the start of an activity, as you may have already realized. The float tells you how much spare time you have for that activity, whether it's in postponing the start date or the activity taking a bit longer than estimated. Identifying the critical path. You may have heard of critical path analysis, CPA, or critical path method, CPM, and think it sounds daunting. However, the good news is that critical path analysis is very easy. In fact, if you've made an activity network, then you've done most of the work already. The critical path is simply the longest chain of dependent activities going through the activity network. You can see it clearly because critical path activities all have a float of zero. The critical path is significant because as the longest path, it determines the duration of the project. The critical path is important in managing the project because if you get a delay on a critical path activity, the longest path gets longer. If the longest path gets longer, that means that the project end date goes out. So slippage on a critical path activity doesn't just affect that activity, but the entire project. As you manage the project, monitor all the activities carefully, but especially look out for the critical path. You also have to consider the resource. Planning isn't just something you do at the start of a project, but rather something you do continuously right the way through. Things change, and unless yours is the first, no project ever goes exactly to plan. Strangely, that's what makes the plan even more important. It's something you adjust in order to keep the project on track. There is a danger that you can get very focused on your network and become so absorbed in the times and dependency arrows that you lose touch with reality. If funding for an activity won't be available until the start of the new financial year, then that's the activity start point and not the end of the previous activity, which may be much earlier. If you're using a computer tool, you can deal with this situation quite easily by specifying a fixed start date for an activity. In this case, first day of the financial year. Make a note in the plan to remind yourself both that you've anchored the start date, in case circumstances change, and the reason, which in this case is the availability of finance. Other reasons include interaction with other projects where staff won't be available to work on your project until they've finished work on another that's higher priority. In thinking through the dependencies for your network, you will find that some things are fixed, but others are a matter of choice. Mandatory dependencies. These relationships must be observed if project work is to be a success. They include hard logic. Certain processes must logically occur before others. For example, when building a house, you must build the foundations before the frame. Legal requirements. Some laws or regulations require that certain activities be done before others. For example, a drug must go through clinical trials before it is mass-produced for distribution. Procedural requirements. Company policies and procedures require that certain activities be done before others. Audit must approve your design for the new financial system before you start to build it. Discretionary dependencies. You may choose to establish these relationships between activities, but they aren't required. They include